I'm going to invite Gemma and John to join us up on the stage as well, and invite Stephen and Graham to take a seat over here in the middle. While people are moving, can I invite you to think a little about what questions you would like to put to the various speakers we've had this morning? Recall the input that we had this morning from Gemma and John's response, all those slides that we saw flash before us that we wanted to hear more about, and have a think about what we want to hear.
Gemma, I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about hopeless hope and how we can go about, when we experience that hopeless hope in our mission, how can we kind of come to life in it? I'm thinking about asylum seekers and the experience of being with them, and what can we say? No visa? No hope of a visa? Where do you go from there? How do you turn it around to God and Jesus?
So the question about hopeless hope, particularly in the context of migration and seeking refuge. You'll have a couple of moments to think about this while I take another couple of questions. Yes.
Thanks to all the panel. It's a very distinguished and daunting group up there. I'd be interested in Graham's reflections on some of Gemma's points and some of Stephen's on hopeless hope and on tenderness, just how that resonates from an Indigenous perspective.
Thank you. One more before we start getting some responses. I'm looking upstairs in case I've missed anyone up there. Yes, in the middle.
A point first. Does this bring in also, as you unpack things as a most astute group, does this involve, I think the word was used, worthlessness, and can that be added into this consideration now? Is worthlessness also something else that's involved in this hopelessness in the other?
So connecting the concept of worth and worthlessness with this idea of hope and hopelessness. Okay. I'm inviting Gemma to respond. A number of those questions were addressed to Gemma, particularly the first one.
Thank you very much for your question. With regard to hoping against hope, actually one of the other points I wanted to raise... Oh, sorry. Okay, I'm just going to go closer to the microphone. Is that good enough? All right. One of the other points I wanted to raise on the idea of wilderness, because that's where kind of that hoping against hope and hopeless sort of hopeless hope comes from, is this writing also of this African-American theologian, Dolores Williams. It's actually called Sisters in the Wilderness, okay? That wilderness spirituality, and she refers to it as making way out of no way. Okay? To go back to you, in relating that to your question, especially in the case of asylum seekers, I wonder if you were able to catch last night ABC's feature on Nauru. I was only able to catch the second half, but it was very interesting for me, especially listening to the young Salvation Army workers and how he was speaking about his own experience, about seeing the stitched lips. And you can sense a kind of a trauma there. That's one other thing I would have loved to talk about is trauma missiology. So in the case of the, I think, on the part of asylum seekers, how do we talk about hopeless hope? I think it's about reminding ourselves, why are we doing this? Going back to our roots. In the same way as when, in the case of the asylum seeker, it's about maybe for him or her to be reminded, why did I move in the first place? Why did I cross borders in the first place? For that dream, for my family. And sometimes going back to the roots, why are we doing this in the first place, has a way of reigniting that passion for life again. Yeah?
Hopefully. Thank you, Gemma. Another of the questions picked up the same question of hope and tenderness and was particularly directed towards Graham. Would you like to respond to that?
I don't know whether the words hope and tenderness go with the word Graham.
His wife's not here either.
But, of course, it's important, as has been said, today, and I think yesterday, is about knowing yourself. Knowing, in my case, that God loves you. And I have learned that through my Catholicism, my interaction with God, and interaction with the people around me. And of course, I also have that from my culture. We talk about the groups like the Stolen Generation. Here in Australia, it's like the schools in Canada and the States. But none of my immediate family were ever taken away. None of my immediate family. But my parents told me of stories of doors being kicked down, children taken away, kids not arriving back from school, which was just down the bottom of the hill from the house. I'm aware of that, but I always knew where I came from. And therefore, I really feel for those people who were of that ilk, the Stolen Generation. But there is always hope in the sense of that these people do belong. They are part of us. You know, in the Aboriginal community of more recent time, there's been these whole discussions about who is really Aborigine and who isn't. That's been going on. And I think it's a load of garbage what people talk about. You either are or you aren't an Aboriginal. These people do exist. They're there. They may be discovering or rediscovering who they are as a people, but they belong to us. They belong to us. They are part of our history and part of our story, as well as part of your story. But I think there is hope out there. I think, you know, if I think back the last 30 years of being involved in church, and I've knocked my heads up against a number of people over the many years, and we have made some steps in the way forward. There's still a long way to go, and I didn't get these grey hairs for nothing. And we are a worthwhile people. You know, going to Wadair or Bathurst Island or Townsville a couple of weeks ago, Rocky, I know, is here, or Melbourne's here, running into some really great, fantastic Aboriginal people who are out there doing the mission work of God. We use the Missio Dei. It's great. They're great people. And that gives me hope in this place. Hopefully that answers your question. I'm full of hope. Yeah, I get down, but things will change.
Thank you, Ram. The third question was about worth and feelings of worthlessness and being of worth and what that's got to do with all of this. So, Stephen or John, who would like to start? John?
He's not worthy.
I think that's a great question on worth because in many ways our whole, you know, when Gemma spoke about the crucified people and people are crucified by a system which is predicated precisely on forms of oppression, the kind of oppression that Graham is alluding to, the ongoing violence of colonisation and dispossession. In many ways, that system, and let's call it for what it is, I'm not afraid to name names, capitalism is completely built on value and worth being linked to money, the system of money, the system of exchange, the system of profit, in other words, the system of commodification. And in many ways, what we're called to prophetically is to resist the commodification of human beings, to resist that notion which tries to peg a person's value according to their position within a power structure. And this is a very, very big ask. I'll just share very quickly a story that brought it home for me. Some years ago, everything was going wrong in our family. It was while we were living in the Blue Mountains in a beautiful old house there. And everything went wrong. Little things like washing machines packing up to the kids being bullied at school to me getting retrenched from my job and then ultimately my wife getting cancer. And that was, you know, it just hit us for a six. A friend said to us, have you thought of getting a smoking done? And so through some local Aboriginal friends, they put us in touch with Uncle Max, who came out and did a smoking around the house, and a personal smoking for my wife, Jackie, which was just a very moving and powerful experience for her. This was all new for us. And then Uncle Max showed me a spot on the land, on a ridge, and explained to me that this was a very ancient meeting place, and that the house, which was built in 1913, cut right through the song line from that ridge to the next. He gave me a little stone and asked me to carry it around with me for a while and then to bury it in that place. I did that, and when I did it, the dogs followed me, and they dug it up. And the funny thing was, when I buried it, I came down the stairs after burying it from this terrace area, and this bird bath, this concrete bird bath, was rent in half. And I thought, oh, that's weird. And that's when I realised something was wrong with the stone, and I reburied it. Uncle Max said to me, oh, look, when you're finished with it, just mail it to me. I said, oh, hang on, you know, maybe I should come and give it to you if it's that special. He goes, nah, I'll never lose that stone, don't worry, it's always going to come back to me. So I did as he asked, and me of little faith, I thought I'd better give him a call after mailing it to him. I said, oh, Uncle Max, you know, did you get the stone? He goes, yeah, no worries, John got it. And then I told him about the bird bath. And, with my rational mind, I'm trying to think there must be some rational explanation. I blamed my wife. I said she must have gone and done it with a power tool. And I thought
as maybe you do.
The kids had done it, or the dogs, that there'd be an earthquake, but there was no rational explanation. So I told him about it. He goes, yeah, that would happen. It's a pretty powerful stone, that. And I thought, well, the point of the story is, I'm sorry for being long-winded, but to me, the people are like that stone. They will never be lost. People will never be lost if we hold them close to our heart. And that's something that looks like it's of little value, worthless, and yet it's the most sacred and powerful presence in the world, the people, the sacrament of the presence of God.
The fundamental dignity of the human person, a dignity that's transcendent and not just of the material world. Let's take maybe three more questions. There's one in the back here in the middle. And there's another one upstairs towards the back. We'll take this one first and then move upstairs. And can you tell us if your question is directed to a particular panel member or not?
Maybe Stephen, but we're just talking about belief in a stone. I was doing science back in the 60s, and half of my lecturers were atheists and humanists and communists. And a lot of my friends today are atheists and agnostics, and some of them are Catholics who've walked away because they can't believe in the words of the creed and so on. So we've been talking here about the presence of God, and that's what we're all on about. But there's so many people out there that I've met, maybe, I guess I got questions myself if I'm really honest about what kind of God I believe. And I know Mother Teresa of Calcutta and Teresa of Lisieux questioned at times. So there's this earlier question. A lot of people do not have a belief in God, and a lot of people, myself included, one times have, what kind of God do I believe in? Yet often we come to conferences like this, it's assumption is everybody believes sort of thing, and the presence of God. So how do you deal with the non-believers and the questioners?
Yes, so mission's not just about talking amongst ourselves about what we already believe, but moving out. Thank you. And there's a question back there, and then we'll take another one in the front here afterwards. But yes, thank you.
To Dr. Falzon, and perhaps Dr. Bevans might like to respond also. Dr. Falzon, you mentioned briefly in your response the national economy. And this is the question. Christian-based welfare organisations in the peer group ACOS are starting to promote the concept that Australians, compared to many in OECD countries, are under-taxed, and this creates injustices in the redistribution of the nation's wealth to the underprivileged and, by extension, those who arrive in this country without accredited documentation. Do you think in a federal election year Australia is prepared for a discussion on the tax system in this country?
Thank you. So quite a specific question there for John. There was a lady in the front of the top layer, yes? And then we'll move to the panel for some responses.
My question probably is to Father Stephen Bevans or one of the others. It's about the media. How can we deal with, I'm not saying confront, the power of the media? I was watching Media Watch last night, and they got so many things, they get so many things wrong, and they broadcast these falsities about, in that case last night, people. And what can be done to mitigate the influence of the media, and even particularly the ABC, who you'd expect to be somebody a bit more upright in journalism? And that's my question, is about how can we mitigate the power of the media?
Mm-hmm. So how do we get our message through in this context of the operation of the media? Okay, well, let's start with the first big question about communicating faith in the context of unbelief. Stephen, would you like to have a go? Everyone looked at you.
Of course, I think if you could answer that question, we would have an easy time with new evangelization and so forth. But I was struck a year ago or so when I read a story, it was like an introduction to a book, something like that, by Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. And he talked about the fact that when he was a younger priest, he was a chaplain at one of the colleges in Oxford. And his practice was to call in the various people, in the college and have a chat with them, to kind of get to know them. And he said inevitably, a young man or a young woman would come in and say, well, Father, it's very nice that you called me in, but I don't believe in God. And Rowan Williams would say, well, okay, that's fine. What kind of God don't you believe in? And so the person would say this, and he would say, well, I don't believe in that God either. I think one of the problems that we have in our preaching and in the perception of our preaching and our communication is that people really are stuck in idol worship, or they are, I think, rightly rejecting these wrong images of God. Vatican II says in Gaudium et Spes that so often we Christians are responsible for obscuring the true face of God. So I think what we have to work at, and I think this is one of the things with the new evangelization, new expression, new methods, new ardor, is to work on really presenting who the God of Jesus Christ is. And so often I do think that we've obscured that. And I think we have to work at that, and then perhaps, people will be attracted and will respond. But I think people are so often caught up in images of God that I sometimes say myself, if that's really what God is like, I think I'd rather go to hell. You know, so I mean, so I think we have to somehow work at presenting that true face of God. You know, and I hope that, you know, and I think it can be found in Jesus, in Jesus's life of you know, of service and self-giving, and we have to, you know, as you know, John Thornhill says, you know, we have to get away from, you know, just the doctrines, and try to present and reimagine the story. And I think if we do that, you know, one of the things I wanted to bring out in my presentation was, I think, you know, for those of us who are ordained, you know, the homily is absolutely important. That's where people come face to face every week, if they go to church anyway, with the message of the gospel. And if we don't really work to make that a real experience of illumination and challenge and so forth, we're simply not doing our job. So I think what we need to do is recognize the fact that probably most people have images of God which are not worthy of the God of Jesus Christ. And we have to somehow help them see that those are idols, and that the things that they reject are probably right in rejecting them. But there's a greater understanding and a greater reality of God.
Thank you, Stephen. Would anyone else on the panel like to move to the other part of the question about communication in the context of contemporary media? Because I think the two are quite linked, aren't they? Yep. Gemma?
I'd like to say something on that, because actually in December last year, I chaired a session on media. I don't know. I think I see some of those who attended the third conference on the pastoral care of migrants and refugees. Sunday, you were there. And it was very interesting, and I know that's a genuine concern, especially here, because they create a kind of a stereotypes, even some, well, we know the power of language, and the media is out there. They're at the forefront. But what I like to point out is that in that same conference, I actually, in my presentation, spoke about the mission to the digital continent. So that means I'd like to expand the concept of media here beyond the newspapers, because our reality today is mass media is all sorts of things. The internet, what do you call this, Skype, or video conference, all sorts, Twitter. So I think that is one mission field, area of mission that we have to seriously look into, especially because that's where our young people are, and the young people are the future of the church. I always say that, especially in the context of migration, mission among the children of migrants is important, not just because the young people are the future of the church, but also because they're the future of the faith in migrant families. So it is very important, precisely because in the context of our world today, engaging the media, and what I'm saying here, we have this saying, if you can't beat them, join them. I would say, if you can't beat them, engage them. Engage them. And I think it's a powerful witness done by Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, how, you know, he was on Twitter. And I remember when I was still teaching in Chicago, and I was telling my students that the Vatican has a YouTube channel, they were really surprised. And you know how our young people are all over using this information technology. How much more knowing that there's this Twitter account and they can engage the church. So I think that is something we have to seriously think about. How do we engage the media? Rather than running away from them, just vilifying them, how do we engage them in such a way that they become our partners in mission as well?
And I'm aware, too, that there are a number of media professionals here with us. I'm quite short-sighted, so I can't really spot whether Beth's here at the moment, but she was telling me last night that the Bishop's Conference, the media office of the Bishop's Conference, has just launched an e-book looking at engaging all the new media. And I saw Marita Winters somewhere earlier, and there are people from Frameworks. So there are people really very much engaged in all of this amongst us. Hunt them down at lunch. I'm sure they've got plenty to say about this. There was one more question that was directed particularly to John about the tax system in an election year.
You didn't think that one could make tax interesting, did you? let me start by saying the founder of Vinnies, a young student activist in 19th century Paris, Frederick Ozanam, famously wrote that charity is the Samaritan who pours oil on the wounds of the traveller who's been attacked, but it is the role of justice to prevent the attack. And that's where the tax system comes in. At the moment in Australia, in prosperous Australia, I thank the person for asking the question, it's a great one. We are a low-taxing country within the context of the OECD. That's the first point that we need to reiterate. Secondly, there are whole cohorts of the population who have been forced to depend on charity as the default mode of delivery of social security. And this is absolutely unconscionable and unacceptable in a country as wealthy as ours. Apart from income insecurity, there is housing insecurity. And there was that great report that Anglicare put out yesterday on how hard it is to survive, particularly in the private rental market. So we're dealing with a situation where there hasn't been an increase to the Newstart allowance since 1994 in real terms. So my response very simply is, yes, we should not be ashamed of any methods by which we can redistribute wealth within a wealthy country. We should not be ashamed of this. Rather, we should see it as an absolute ethical imperative. The reason for that is very simple. To quote the words of Bertolt Brecht, the German poet, forgive his non-inclusive language, but he produced this wonderful little ditty that sums it up so beautifully. He said, "Rich man and his poorer brother stood and looked at one another till the poor man softly swore, 'You'd not be rich if I weren't poor.'" And that's the reality. So, yes, we must champion that call for a redistribution. But let me add this important caveat. It's not just a redistribution of wealth. It is a redistribution of hope that we need. Because along with income poverty goes that sense of being humiliated and having one's dignity taken away. And one thing goes with the other. The 80,000 single mums that were pushed onto the lower Newstart allowance as of January the 1st this year, not only has it become very, very hard to make ends meet for these courageous women, but there is a sense of deep humiliation by what happened. And the terrible irony is that that legislation snuck through the lower house on the very evening of the day in which the Prime Minister gave her absolutely inspiring speech on misogyny. And on that day, these were, talk about worthless, these were the forgotten women. These were the women who didn't count. These were the women who weren't as important and who were being vilified in a lot of the public discourse as if they were lazy and not willing to work. In fact, we know that around 60% are already in some paid work. I'll just end on a note of hope vis-a-vis that agenda and also the media, though. A few years ago, during one of the Howard era iterations of welfare reform, so-called, and again, it was the sole parents who were in his target. I had to do a fair bit of media interviews because Vinnies, of course, was very critical of this. I'd done the shock jocks and knew what to expect. Stupid me, as I was about to do a radio interview with ABC, I thought I made this ridiculous assumption through my own personal prism that this was going to be a bit more of a gentler exchange than the ones with Alan Jones and co. So I did the interview, and lo and behold, the interviewer absolutely gave me a run for my money, and she was saying things like, you know, so, Dr. Falzon, the St. Vincent de Paul Society wants single mothers to sit on their backsides and get money for nothing. Is that what you're saying? And I thought, you beauty of stoush, this is great. But it wasn't what I expected. So she just kept hammering, doing the government line. Anyway, the interview was over, and she said, John, are you still on the line? I said, yes. She said, we're off air now, but I just need to mention to you the ABC has to be completely impartial. And I said, oh, thank you very much for that. That's very kind of you. And she said, but John, really, I'm a single mum myself, and I reckon this legislation sucks. It's criminal. Go Vinnies.
So you need to be a bit prepared for a rigorous exchange of views if you're going to take on the media in this context. Graham?
I just want to say one thing. My wife and I have sat down on many occasions talking about, lots of things in life, but on this particular case we were talking about tax, and we don't mind paying tax, and I think it's very important that we do. I know some of you may be shocked to hear that he is an Aborigine and he pays tax. But it's important that we do pay tax, and I think I have, and therefore I should give. And that's one of the philosophies that I have, and I find it very difficult, of course, with some of the current fundraising that some of the organisations do, because a lot of the fundraising is, well, I'll give you something, but I'll get something back out of it. But that's not what giving is all about. I have, therefore I should give. It's not a case of getting something out of it in that sense. And I think we've got to think about that. I pay tax. I work for the church, so I don't do that well, but at least I get something.
Thank you. Yes, it's about the discourse, isn't it? Some of the conversation about taxation is quite ideological, and we're not thinking about it in terms of sharing and promoting the common good. I think we have time for one more round of three questions. I can see one downstairs here. I'm just checking that I'm not missing anyone upstairs. Okay, so here, and then another one down here, just a little further forward. Would there be a third one, or we're all in, all done, as the auctioneer would say? Okay, so we'll hear these two questions and then we'll get responses. Thank you.
Not for a specific person, happy for anyone to answer it, but there's a question around our use of language. And I think, Father Stephen, in what you've been talking about, this sense of the Trinity being the pure relationship and listening and communion and communication. And yet quite often in our own language within church, we tend to objectify. And if we take the Trinity as the eternal I-thou relationship, it's pure subject. And yet we keep objectifying. We keep saying, or I hear as I go around to my parishes, what are we going to do about the young people? What are we going to do about... Well, what are we going to do about the 50-year-olds or about the 80-year-olds? Or all we talk about, and I'm sorry, Dr. Gemma, and with all due respect, but we talk about the youth being the future of the church. Well, at what age do they stop? Do you stop being the future of the church at 15 or 16? And when do you become the past of the church? Do you stop being the past of the church at 83 or 71, or, you know, I think more and more, if we're looking at this sense of relationship, we need to be looking at how are we using language? Because if we're all the body of Christ, then we all need that tenderness, that openness and listening, because we are all part of the health, and we are all part of the difficulties we have. Thank you.
A little bit tempted to do a Tony Jones and take it as a comment, but I'm sure that The panel will respond to that. We had one more person just here. Microphone's on its way.
I found your presentation, Dr. Gemma, a real blast. It was great. And it had connections and resonance for me across into thinking about women's liberation, and having attended the Women Mission and Liberation yesterday, particularly the words creative resistance and Eucharistic expression, the use of food. Women church, you didn't use that word, I don't think. But I would have wanted you to speak about women and the migrant thing much more precisely than you did. Could you please speak about their numbers, their impact on this hoping into a fraught situation?
Thank you. So we've got two questions.
Can you say the last part of your question again, please?
How do women show leadership in this situation of migration in the way you were talking? Because you were speaking about the role of food, celebration, Eucharistic context, women church, and as far as I was concerned, women liberation and creative resistance. Those were the words I heard.
So we've got two quite related questions talking about how we use language and how we can tend to objectify particular categories of people. And one is directed particularly towards Gemma. Would you like to start?
Yeah, thank you for your questions. I would like to address the first one. I see where you're coming from. But actually, when I said the youth are the future of the church, I'm not speaking in terms of chronological age or something like that. I'm referring to the young people as the very same people who will be teaching in the classrooms, who will be our priests, who will be our missionaries, who will be the future leaders in the church. I do not limit leadership, for instance, to if you're 50 or you're 60. We have young leaders here. We have heard three angelic voices reminding us that we have many voices this morning at the opening of our prayer. And by that, I also mean, there's this saying by an Asian sage, tell me about your youth and I'll tell you about your future. So I would rather not confine, when I say young or youth, young people, to age, but a kind of a spectrum. Yeah, hopefully. So that is my response to what you point. But of course, I understand where you're coming from. The second one, women and leadership in the context of migration. That's an entirely different discussion. You probably need a week. But that's an area that I will be looking at, actually, because I am doing research right now on women and migration, particularly the migration of third world women, and the whole discussion on where is women's leadership in migration. Does migration become a source for women's empowerment? There is a kind of a conflicting debate, actually, on that. Some would argue that migration allows women in their struggle for empowerment, particularly women from the third world, or at the very least, women who migrate from patriarchal societies, because migration affords them a kind of agency. You may call it economic agency, political agency, because women who migrate, especially those who are working, kind of transition into a different role from a dependent to being the breadwinners. And many of the women I meet, especially migrant workers, women workers in Asia, it transforms gender relations in the household, but sometimes even among parents and the women themselves. And you know how it is, especially in patriarchal societies and especially in Asia, in patriarchal families, the power of the parents. But when the daughter is the one who goes away and provides the money, bread on the table, constructs a house for the parents, sends money for the parents' health care, there is a kind of a steering of the power relationship. So I could go on and on, but on the other hand, there's also this discussion of Well, migration, especially when you look at the work of women migrants in the church, it tends to reinforce the imbalance in the gender relations, because when you look at migrant women's role in the church, they tend to do the work that are associated with women's work. The food, the cooking, giving the religious education classes, and some other roles which might be seen as traditionally women's work and women's role. I'll leave it at that. Yeah, we can talk.
It's a very big conversation, isn't it? And in our context too, we see the internationalisation, the outsourcing of caring work to poor women. Yeah, there are so many questions involved in your question. It is time for us actually to thank our guest speakers. And I'm just looking around. We've got the Catholic mission team coming down to the front. And is Maureen here? If I could ask Maureen and Therese to join us on the stage, that would be lovely. You might have thought yesterday that you were going to get away without, you know, embarrassing displays, but no. Stephen, could I invite you to come forward to receive a gift of an appreciation? Lana, are you presenting? Yes. We'd like to thank Stephen for his two excellent speeches, helping us to unpack the meaning of mission and how we go about it, what it is. And we have a small present to thank you for your work with us. Thank you very much, Stephen. Maureen, thank you so much for your talk yesterday. It was very challenging, and I'm still thinking about that very long list of the things that we expect of leaders. No wonder people aren't always putting their hands up for it. Thank you so much for sharing with us. Therese, you did such an excellent job in helping us to work out, well, what does all of that mean practically? You're such a practical doer in the church. Thank you so much for your response. Gemma, I think we're going to be talking about your paper for a very long time. Personally, I wanted to go for a walk for half an hour and think about it. There was just so much in it. Thank you so much for your sharing with us today. John, thank you for your response to Gemma's paper this morning. It really brought alive a number of the images and the life issues in that paper. Thank you so much for being with us. Graham, thank you so much for your presence with us through the conference, for your involvement in our opening ceremony, which was so moving for so many of us, and for responding in such a deep way to Stephen's paper today. Thank you very much.